Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, David James Gonzalez, and I'm pleased to be speaking with Alex Chavez, author of the award-winning book, Sounds of Crossing, Music, Migration, and the Oral Poetics of Huapango Aribeño, published as part of the Refiguring American Music Series by Duke University Press in 2017. Alex Chavez is an artist, scholar, producer, and the Nancy O'Neill Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Notre Dame, where he is also a faculty fellow of the Institute for Latino Studies. As a cultural anthropologist trained in linguistic anthropology, ethnomusicology, and folklore, Chavez's research explores articulations of Latinx sounds and orality in relation to race, placemaking, and the intimacies that bind lives across physical and cultural borders. He has consistently crossed the boundary between performer and ethnographer in the realms of both academic research and publicly engaged work as an artist and producer. Chavez has recorded and toured with his own music projects, composed documentary scores, most recently the Emmy Award-winning El Despertar, and collaborated with Grammy Award-winning artists. He has published widely in various academic journals and public venues. His most recent publication is the article Gender, Ethno-Nationalism, and the Anti-Mexicanist Trope, published in the 2021 winter issue of the Journal of American Folklore. He is co-editor of the forthcoming edited volume Ethnographic Refusals, Unruly Latinidades, published by SAR Press, which grows out of an advanced seminar he co-chaired at the School for Advanced Research in 2019. In 2020, he was named one of 10 Mellon Emerging Faculty Leaders by the Institute for Citizens and Scholars, formerly known as the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation, and also recently concluded a National Endowment for the Humanities long-term fellowship at the Newberry Library in Chicago. He currently serves as a governor on the Chicago chapter board of the Recording Academy. Hello, Alex, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hello, buen dia. I'm really grateful to be here and to in conversation with you. Thanks for the invitation.
I appreciate you accepting it. And to get us started, if you can just tell us a bit about yourself.
Yes, so I'm originally from Texas, from West Texas, little town called Midland. I feel like most people associate Midland with its neighboring town, Odessa. So Midland, Odessa. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, so small West Texas towns, you know, red dirt towns, a lot of cotton out there, and oil country. The reason I grew up out there, my parents are both from Mexico, and they migrated to the U.S. They're very young. My mother is like 13. She was originally from the state of Zacatecas. My father, he's 15, 16 years old when he migrated, and he's from the state of Querétaro. And so they migrated, and they met out in West Texas. Different circumstances as to how they ended up out there, largely questions of family and work. And I was subsequently born out there and grew up out there. And my background in that regard is, you know, having grown up in a kind of the cultural and sort of kind of social milieu of being in a migrant community, mainly Mexican migrant community, and the context for that, at least growing up, although you don't realize it, I guess, when you're in it, but I do recall, and you know, the context for it in terms of what I subsequently realized or shaped me are one, the kinds of connections among family and extended family that, connect, you know, particularly that place to particular parts of Mexico. And what that means is in terms of people going back and forth and different kinds of restricted mobilities, whether, you know, undocumented or have work permits or et cetera. But going back and forth as labor migrants and the connections to Mexico and to, you know, really getting a sense of, you know, both places or both countries kind of being connected and both at once being home in a way to the people around me. And so, you know, that I think was very much part of my experience growing up. And the other was this kind of larger sense of citizenship or, you know, what it means to be a migrant in relation to kind of society at large. And clearly as a kid, you don't think about it in these ways, but you do realize, at least for me, that, well, for a good part of my childhood, my mother and father were undocumented. So, you know, that experience, you know, even again, you're in it as a kid and you see the struggles and you see, you know, the daily challenges that people face, in this case my parents and other family, and you know, that sort of thing really shapes you in terms of your understanding of, you know, who they are, you know, what sort of how they live their lives, what becomes meaningful, you know. And then for me, having to kind of find my way through the world as a child of migrants, and what that meant, you know, at the level of, you know, school or being bilingual, and that, like, you know, I know a lot of folks have this experience where you become a translator for your parents as a kid, you know, things of that nature, and then the sort of broader kind of bicultural experience too, right, of being, you know, Mexican heritage in the United States and growing up with, you know, this sort of worlds of sort of cultural influence, you know, American, U.S. American, Mexican, the connections in between. And yeah, I mean, I grew up out West Texas and that was sort of my world. And I subsequently, once I graduated high school, I found myself at the University of Texas at Austin. So it's still in Texas, but the state capital, and going to school at UT. You know, when it's kind of unique, I guess, my situation around my relationship to the University of Texas. And that is that, you know, I went there for, you know, undergraduate, you know, for university. I studied Mexican American studies and what they call government there, which is, you know, political science. And we can get into this, but due to a number of circumstances in terms of my interests and the work that I would subsequently end up doing, particularly doctoral work, I ended up staying at UT for my graduate work, which again, because I mentioned it's unique because it's not too common, right? I feel like
right,
folks go folks go to a place to go to college and then go to graduate school somewhere else. It was just a set of circumstances as to why it just felt kind of right to stay there, and so I did. But yeah, that's a little bit about where I grew up, you know, West Texas, that sort of experience for me of kind of being part of this migrant community and how that shaped me in part.
Right, and I appreciate you, you know, just sharing a little bit about that experience of, you know, that it was But, you know, pursuing graduate school, it is typically the norm that you go somewhere else, right? Different from your undergraduate institution. I mean, I remember when I was making that decision, I really wanted to stay at my undergraduate institution. It was phenomenal for what I wanted to do. But then my advisor was like, no, you got to go somewhere else or you can never come back, right? But something that I always mention with the students that I advise is, and this goes on to, I think, eventually careers that we pursue too, is it's all about fit, you know, finding what works for you, right? The strategy for success, in my opinion, of finding either what's the right graduate program or the right job or opportunity is not necessarily looking at a list of the best places to go or the best jobs to do, but taking into consideration one's, you know, own needs, both personal as well as your professional aspirations, and finding that best place that fits you, you know. So
yeah, certainly, and one aspect of that too that's really important that sort of plays into, you know, my decision and, you know, my story in that way is, you know, you should try and make that decision based on everything that you mentioned, but a part of that or one dimension of that is, you know, what are the questions that you're asking in terms of research, and, you know, what institution, what place, you know, that you feel where you can, you know, really pursue that sort of those questions, the passion you have for that work topically, etc. And that's largely a question of, yes, the program, you know, depending on what you're studying, but also who's there to work with, right? And
yeah.
So,
totally.
And then, you know, what's the sort of, you know, historically, maybe what might be the kind of intellectual landscape that you might find at a place where you feel like you can, you know, you really want to find your way through. And that to me, you know, should be of utmost importance. You know, I think, you know, I had the opportunity to go other places, you know, that I applied and was accepted to, but it just, you know, made sense to stay at Texas, but for these reasons. You know, and again, I mean, that's my story. That was my experience.
Right.
Yeah.
When you talk about place and placemaking so much in the book, which we'll get into, but it sounds like to me that, you know, place is essential, right, too, for this. When I just looking forward to, I'm not sure how early, and perhaps you can tell us, you know, when did this project start to form? Like how early did you have an idea, right, that your research, say, was going to be tied to not just Central Texas, but that, you know, being near the border and you know, being able to travel, you know, frequently, you know, to Mexico, right? And I don't know. So how much did that factor? Did that factor into it as well? Did you have an idea that early as an undergrad that worked similar to this is what you wanted to do?
You know, no, I did know that. I just since I was a kid, I was, you know, passionate about school and learning and the kind of process of discovery when you're interested in something and academically. And so I got a sense immediately once I got to college that I wanted to go to graduate school, you know. And I think part of that realization was also that I was fortunate, you know, when I got to college that I found a really amazing community of student activists, people doing community work that had been connected to Austin historically for a long time. This kind of legacy of kind of civil rights, particularly like Mexican American Chicano civil rights kind of, work and organizing that was very much connected to university. And, you know, so whether it was a number of organizations run by students of color or, you know, the kind of MECHA or even just like the Center for Mexican American Studies, all these, you know, sorts of, you know, different, you know, kind of slices of kind of the community of folks that was doing this kind of work. And I found myself immediately connected to, you know, to this to this scene, to this community, people doing, you know, social justice organizing. And as an undergraduate, but what was really, I guess my point is, what was really kind of, among other things, but what was really impactful was that there were a lot of graduate students also kind of in community with undergraduates, which is not typical. And so, I got to meet really amazing graduate students who were studying everything from, you know, history to anthropology to, you know, sociology or education, who were, you know, there side by side with undergrads, you know, organizing on and off campus. And, you know, it was through my connections with these older students, these graduate students who were, you know, I sort of discovered what graduate school was and what did that mean, and, you know, got some sense of that process as one of kind of training and education. And I kind of knew immediately, like, I want to keep going to school and do that. But I didn't necessarily know in what. But I guess so. That's one aspect, right? Like graduates, I guess one thing I didn't mention before is that being, you know, first generation, child of migrants, I'm also first generation in my immediate family, and actually largely my extended family, to go to college. So I had no point of reference to what is it to go to graduate school, So it was through this process of kind of collective mentorship, I suppose, in this community of folks that I learned what that meant, what that was. And so, you know, so that, but then, you know, I guess to even go back a little further to kind of address your question around why this topic. I come from a musical family. My father's a musician who plays multiple instruments, but mainly his instrument's guitar, and he sings, and he played music professionally for a long time as well. And then so I always surrounded not just music in the house, you know, as he and my mother were sort of music appreciators, but also him as a musician and sort of that being part of my world growing up. And so, and his father and his grandfather, so my grandfather and great-grandfather were musicians as well. So I'm fourth-generation musician, but so, you know, being part of a musical family, was part of, my experience growing up. And so I started playing music when I was really young, piano at first, and then picked up guitar later. And then, you know, once I hit my teenage years, I think with a little bit more of consciousness, I started to gravitate toward and want to learn traditional Mexican musics, among them huapango, which, you know, from the region where my father's from in Querétaro, that's one of, you know, one of the styles of music that's from there, that's part of that region, and that is, you know, I guess ostensibly part of my musical heritage. And by that point, I also had this sense and understanding that my grandfather and great grandfather played huapango. They were huapango musicians way back when. And so, with a bit more kind of understanding and consciousness, when I was, you know, a teenager, I sort of got this, you know, kind of sense and desire of wanting to learn and pick up some of these instruments and learn some of that style. And so I did. I kind of embarked on that journey, and part of which was really learning in Mexico. Being in West Texas, there was really no community of musicians that played this style or that were familiar with it. But when we would go back to Mexico, to Querétaro, I would seek out musicians, family, friends that were musicians, and just, you know, taking lessons and learning. And that's where my journey began in terms of just, getting close to this world of music making, but as a student. So fast forward when I'm in college, going to school and, being involved in you know, sort of this kind of political organizing and all the rest that I was mentioning before, and getting a sense of what graduate school was. That's sort of the background to these different experiences I was having as a student and a musician in Austin, Texas. So Austin, you know, famous for, you know, having a quite vibrant live music scene and sort of just scene of musicians and kind of the infrastructure for music making, live and otherwise, and a whole host of communities that do stuff there, you know, from rock to blues to, you know, all kinds of música latina, traditional and otherwise. And so I started playing music with other people and by myself, was in a couple of projects long term. But, you know, one thing that I was doing, I did start playing to traditional music a bit. And, you know, through that world in Austin, you know, you meet people and you network and all the rest. And someone, a friend, was, you know, sort of let me know that there were Huapango musicians in Austin, which, you know, sort of blew my mind, because I my taken for granted sort of cultural atlas about where this music existed, particularly Huapango Arribeño as a style, was, you know, in north central Mexico and in Guanajuato, Querétaro, San Luis Potosí. The thought that there were musicians doing the same thing, you know, here, you know, or there in Austin was too much to pass up. I was like, well, I got to meet these folks. And so I did. I sought folks out and I met them. And frankly, I came to that context and that community of musicians as a musician myself. So I was just playing music for a couple of years. There was no aspiration to like study, quote unquote, this music or this community. Uh-huh. But you know, I guess to circle back, after sort of being in that context, you know, for that amount of time, and getting a sense that I still wanted to go to school, but I guess most importantly, having a particular window into that community, because many of them were undocumented, many of them kind of were from that north central Mexican region. It was like a mirror to me, because it reminded me so much of, you know, how I grew up and the people that I knew and family and all the rest. And so there was a sort of connection and understanding around, at the very least, like the world of sort of migrant life that was very familiar to me. And so as I was performing and playing music and learning, I just, all these questions started to emerge for me about the role this music played in kind of shaping that experience of kind of transnational migrant life. And so with those questions in mind, I recall approaching both Richard Flores and Jose Limon, who ended up being on my doctoral committee, you know, asking them, you know, and being familiar with their work at this point, you know, as an undergrad. It's like, hey, so look, this is what I've been doing. So I basically telling them everything I just told you. And I was like, can I study this? And they're like, yeah, of course you can. And I was like, okay, well, what, how? And they're both like, well, anthropology probably be the best. And I was like, okay, well, let's see about doing that. And so for graduate school, and like I said, you know, the reason why I stayed at Texas, however, was because if you know anything about the sort of scholarly intellectual landscape when it comes to sort of anthropology, particularly anthropology of the borderlands, specifically focused on expressive culture or cultural forms in this regard, I mean, yeah, University of Texas is, you know, has quite a robust history, and a really important place and point of reference for this, you know, genealogy of you know, intellectual work that has explored those very issues, you know, amid this cross section of, yes, cultural anthropology, yes, Mexican American studies, what we would call borderlands anthropology, and of course, ethnomusicology, folklore, linguistic anthropology. Like, it's a quite unique place at an institutional level. And so, well, given what I was just about to embark on with respect to Huapango Ribeño as an, you know, as a topic, well, it just made sense to me. Well, why would I go anywhere else? You know,
right.
I mean, yeah, I mean, there's no, probably no other place that would be, you know, in my opinion, as kind of that would provide the same kind of experience and training and benefit of perspectives, multiple perspectives, than Texas. So I stayed.
Gotcha. Right. You know, obviously this was new to me, this musical form and genre, Huapango Ribeño. Can you tell us more about, you've mentioned a little bit the region that the music comes from. Can you tell us a bit more about like the composition of the groups, right? The roles, you know, how many are in this group, what makes up an ensemble, what are their roles? And I guess we'll begin with that, you know, so a little bit about that, you know, genre again and the ensemble itself, for those of us that aren't as familiar with it.
Sure. So I guess let's start with the terms and then we can maybe situate the style and then kind of get specific around, you know, what the ensemble actually looks like. But you know, huapango as a term I think is very familiar to many appreciators of Mexican music, and so huapango as a word is derived from the Nahuatl guapanco, which means atop of the wood. So, and that signifies like atop of the tarima or the wooden platform that, you know, a lot of Mexican string music particular is danced on, you know, so we can all sort of imagine that, right? The zapateado dance, the sort of patterned footwork. So what does that indicate? Well, huapango, I guess, in a way, it references dance or ritual dance, yes, as a practice and also as a space, because oftentimes people say, vamos a ir a un huapango, we're going to go to a huapango, to a, you know, sort of social space that's a performance that's centered around music and dance. And in a way, apart from ritual dance and the sort of the space of performance, huapango is also synonymous with another term that is a reference for the same thing, and that's the fandango. The fandango, again, has a very long history with colonial New Spain and Spain. But this sort of space of performance centered around music, making, dance, and ritual poetry. So huapango means those things, but it also means quite specifically a rhythm that people are very familiar with. And there are different variants of that rhythm. And just, you know, you can, you know, banda interprets huapangos, música norteña interprets huapangos, and of course, música de cuerda or string music also interprets huapangos. But it's a signature rhythm, and it's a rhythm that you count it in three, and most people say it's in 6/8. It's this, if I can sort of mouth it out, it's this teke 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 teke. When you hear that pulse, that 6/8 pulse, in whatever variation, most appreciators of Mexican music so can recognize that, oh, that's huapango. So, you know, huapango, arribeño is, you know, Highlander from up top, and that's a reference to the mountainous region of here where these three states come together in north central Mexico, which are Guanajuato, San Luis Potosí, and Querétaro. That's where this kind of the cradle of this particular music. Now, just to kind of step back a little bit and give us some context here is huapango in its variant forms, and there are largely only two, huapango arribeño and huasteco. We can kind of get into that, but it's sort of nested in this larger supra-genre of Mexican music that people call son. There are different types of son, you know, son de la tierra caliente, son jarocho, son ismeño, son huasteco, and the list goes on. Basically, what son is string music, okay? Música de cuerda, string music, meaning that, you know, the primary instrumentation are stringed instruments, right? Different kinds of guitars, you know, vihuelas, jaranas, etc., violins, harps, things of that sort. And that's an important distinction to make because, you know, son as a supergenre music is distinctive in that regard. And also a couple other reasons too. It's largely played in triple meter, like huapango. Its primary lyrical conventions are Spanish poetic forms. And I can talk a little bit more about that, but why do I mention that? I mention that because it's important to distinguish son from other quite huge genres of Mexican music. Because we have to understand that the landscape of sort of vernacular traditional Mexican music is vast. It's huge.
Right. Yeah.
So son is one super genre, and it's distinguished from, let's say, música norteña, accordion-based mm-hmm. music from northern Mexico, which its anchoring instruments are what? Well, the accordion and bajo sexto, or, you know, a brass and woodwind-based ensembles of banda, right, that come from mm-hmm. the Pacific Coast region. And we can, or even to think about the epic ballad tradition that is the corrido, right? So mm-hmm. You have all these genres, right? And among them are this kind of super genre called son, string music, played in triple meter, Spanish poetic forms are its primary lyrical conventions. And among the different variants of son are huapango, or the huapango variants. And so, you know, the huapango ribeño specifically, to kind of cascade down here, comes from Guanajuato, San Luis Potosí, and Querétaro, that particular region. The ensemble itself is made up of four instruments, two violins, a vihuela or jarana, which is smaller kind of stringed instruments, depending on who's playing. And then this kind of larger eight-string modified guitar, very, very similar to the kind of typical guitar, but it's a bit different. It's called a guitarra quinta huapanguera, and that instrument is played by what in the tradition people refer to as a poet or a troubadour, un trovador, un poeta, who plays this kind of central role in the ensemble as, you know, someone who conveys through poetics, largely in the form of Spanish décimas, all manner of things. They always have to have a sort of corpus of work that they both have memorized for any occasion, if it's going to be a wedding or it's going to be the new year or an ejido or something like that. And they have to have sort of the ability to improvise as well. And so one last thing I'll mention in terms of, you know, that four-person ensemble and the central figure being the poet or trovador is that the kind of the ideal performance setting for huapango ribeño is what's referred to as a topada, from the verb topar, to collide with. And what it is where two ensembles engage in a sort of ritual performance of kind of poetic and musical dueling, and this lasts for hours, so anywhere from 8 to 12 hours of these musicians, these two ensembles, going back and forth in this kind of, again, this dialogic musical and poetic, you know, exchange that lasts, you know, all night. Typically it happens at night, and the way it's structured is that these raised wooden benches that are referred to as tablados, both ensembles sort of they straddle these, one on either edge of a space in between them, which ostensibly serves as a dance floor. So you have one ensemble at one end and one ensemble out yonder at the other end, and the dancing public in between. And these ensembles go back and forth, having a musical and poetic conversation for hours while, you know, the audience dances through the night. So that's a topada. And they happen for different kinds of occasions, you know, weddings or, again, the new year or patron saint festivity, all manner of things.
Right. Thank you for that. You've explained obviously very well the not only, you know, the origins, the genre of it, appreciate that. And so that's the musical aspect of it, at least some of it. What that collides with and what you bring that into your work is, you know, the experience of migration, particularly transnational, you know, Mexico to US, unauthorized migration. So bring that together for us, you know, in your book. You know, how does this experience of migration, how does that shape this genre? How has it shaped this genre? And how is this this musical form, this art form, right, also used by these performers or huapangueros as a way to translate, right, narrate, describe their lived experience?
Yeah, certainly. You know, I should also kind of return to what I was previously mentioning about when I was in the, you know, sort of in the kind of having the experience of just playing music and being a student, really, and then a number of questions beginning to emerge for me in that setting. You know, I came to sort of be curious and interested in not just, you know, the how this music existed now in the States. In other words, like it's as a form, it's migration to somewhere else. But rather, you know, how it existed across multiple places, or rather how it might perform a role in connecting people, you know. Because, you know, these mobilities are not linear. They never are. And you know, so far more kind of productive or interesting or really true to life, you know, sort of concern or question or dimension of this is like, well, how does this cultural form and practice participate in connecting people? Because it became somewhat apparent to me, you know, that one, you know, Huapango performance was the sort of site of quite moving congregation. And moving in two senses, I came to realize quite quickly, moving in terms of quite literal embodied moving, right? Like, you know, these are bailes, these are dances, right? This is it's a celebration. Es fiesta, the huapango es fiesta. So moving in that embodied sense, and then also moving in the emotive sense, right? You know, like think of like being moved to tears, right? So there was an emotional kind of component to this that, you know, the sort of the power of both those sort of senses of moving to me, I became kind of interested in, if, you know, and part of that animating interest to me was actually performing, being it, and you know, it, the embodied experience of performing there, right? So, and being alongside practitioners and doing, and being, you know, what we would call anthropology, right? Participant, observer, etc. Those. Uh-huh. So, you know, that experience for me, you know, in terms of the power of kind of congregation in that regard, to connect it kind of back to this sense of how it was participating in migrant life as a sound, as an experience, as a musical form and cultural form, I think then opened up this further set of questions that, you know, I guess were at the heart of what I was noticing was like why I, this was just far more than just like, oh, here's this music that exists here now, like some sort of musical migration. But
right, yeah,
you know, it was the connectivity between places and these moments of congregation that became apparent to me in two different kinds of ways. One, what was being spoken about, mm-hmm. was quite powerful, and two, the actual movement of musicians and people across the border existing in both places in varied ways and varied capacities. And no matter what, that this particular sound became part of the sort of the social fabric of that experience, or it was rather, you know, it came, those things became apparent to me. So, you know, I would just say this, you know, connecting then that to just this broader question of migration, I think I kind of came down, you know, to really embracing this much broader analytic that I was, you know, being trained at Texas and kind of doing the kind of work that I was doing in the classroom and with my mentors, that this sense of borderlands really came to be top of mind for me as I was thinking about these things that I'm kind of conveying here, in the sense that, you know, we have the scholarly field of border studies, right, which is quite concerned with the kind of material conditions of the U.S.-Mexico border as a concrete physical place. And then we have this sort of metaphorical use of the borderlands as, you know, as this kind of perspective that speaks to the kind of liminal state of in-betweenness.
Right.
And, you know, the borderlands studies, you know, sort of integrates both of these perspectives, right? So, you know, and you can't have one without the other. This is to say that, you know, when we think about, for instance, I often give this example, if we think about the border as a physical place today, well, it's the result of an imperial war in the mid-19th century. Well, you know, that imperial war is being driven by these sort of racial ideologies of westward expansion, which are themselves, right, motivated by these particular kinds of borders that people are imagining between, right, sort of white sort of inheritors of democracy and civilization and, right, those backward, racialized, right, sort of savages, etc., right, that are Mexican, Native American, African American. And so that particular sort of cultural allegorical divide is the animating kind of energy, the sort of social energy behind westward expansion. So you can't, which results in the border that we know today. So those racial ideologies are key to producing the border as a physical place. And, you know, you fast forward to the 21st century, they still continue to be the case. And so, you know, thinking, you know, about the materiality of the border in this particular migrant community's sort of lived experience, yes, it's about understanding how people move across back and forth and how policy shapes lives and how, you know, particularly this sort of juridical apparatus of illegality has a lot to do with sort of, you know, how migrant lives are sort of structured and constructed and subjectivities are created and lived out. While at the same time, you have this entire immaterial kind of aspect of a migrant experience, which is sort of cultural, which is in this case embodied in music and sound and performance, that, you know, to think about this borderlands perspective that takes into account both, you know, and which, mind you, Gloria Anzaldúa herself, you know, makes this distinction, right? She says, you know, that a dividing line is a border and the emotional residue of an unnatural boundary is a borderland, right? So to me, that interplay between both the material and the immaterial became embodied in sound, particularly this sound of Huapango Guerrereño. And so what I came to sort of, you know, which is the book chronicles this, but, you know, where I sort of landed was that, you know, this is one particular embodied practice through which migrants lend meaning to their own migration.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's sort of the story here, you know. Because there are a number of narratives that we hear about migration and migrants, right? Well, what are their narratives, right? What are their stories, or how are they lending meaning to that same sense of mobility and those same violences and those same experiences? What do they carry with them to, you know, to live out their lives amidst all of this? And so sometimes it's in these things that we might not think are inherently political, and they really aren't, but they happen and they unfold in contexts that make them politicized.
Right. Yeah. I was exactly thinking that. I'm thinking of a few of your key interlocutors in this work. Don Lencho Olvera, Zenobio, Homero, Graciano, and Salomon. Can you explain, you know, along the same line? I mean, you mentioned towards, I think towards the latter part of the book that you see these huapangueros as ethnographers, right? They're doing so much more, right? So much more than just performing, right, as entertainment, right? This is, there's that aspect of it, as you've explained, but there's so much more than that, right? And so the book follows their movements. I appreciate you bringing that up, right? Yeah, it's not just a migration heading northward. Wapango Arribeño, you know, comes to U.S. and I think you mentioned the 80s, but then it's like in the 90s that these men, through networks, through their own migration patterns, they come together and they start performing together. And so in this process of doing this and moving across borders, can you tell us more of, again, you know, what are they saying, right? What is it that they are communicating to those willing to listen?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, let's take this anthropological analytic at its word here, right? So, you know, ethnography, as you know, you go somewhere, you find something out, and then you sort of translate that, you know, in textual form, typically. Of some sort. But, you know, two things are sort of going on here, two that sort of kind of are kind of important to mention, I guess, in the context of this conversation is that, you know, one, that in the sort of within the purview of kind of the methodological practice of ethnography and finding something out and textualizing it, you know, me coming to understand Wapango Arribeño practitioners as or it as ethnographic and Wapangueros as ethnography or ethnographers, is, you know, really rooted in this understanding that the kind of experiential and narrative space of Wapango was shaped by these broader methodological and theoretical approaches in which that musical form itself was unfolding. What was key to it? What was at its core? Particularly its poetics, particularly its performance. Now, thinking of in those terms, I know, requires perhaps a rethinking of ethnography beyond the ways it exists in the kind of walls of academic institutions. But, you know, but there is, and I write about this, that there is kind of support for this kind of an approach, particularly in related conceptualizations around the body and place and time, particularly in feminist theory, and I mentioned Antaldúa and Saldúa before, you know, providing these kinds of theorizations. But what am I getting at? I'm getting at the fact that, you know, as I was exploring this music, exploring its performance, learning, you know, being in these spaces, you know, and I write about this, I believe it's in the second chapter or the Compañeros del Destino chapter, where I detail all the sort of threads and aspects and dimensions of performance practice. You know, these are aspects of Wapango Arribeño as a form of performance that I came to learn by doing it, you know, because... And what did I learn? Well, I learned that there was this robust, incredibly robust theory of performance and methodology of performance that was integral, that was deep and necessary to this performance style. In terms of, in other words, that these musicians and the audiences also had a sense of this, that there existed these other kinds of analytics that were integral to performance, again, in terms of a theory of performance and methodology. And what am I talking about? Well, it's when they say el destino, or when they say reglamento, or even the kind of the idea of compañeros del destino, like all these sorts of analytics and components of performance were key and central to its meaning, right, to the way in which it unfolds. And so, you know, this kind of forced me to really quite seriously, you know, take, you know, this performance and its, what it accomplishes within the context of its connection to communities, right? That it required me to sort of take it at its own terms and understand it as an intellectual process of knowledge production. And so there's a power in that, and it's something that's not typical in how we think about doing anthropology, right? You know, anthropology is quite sticky with its sort of residues of, you know, coloniality, and it particularly its heritage that it's, you know, has colluded with colonialism quite specifically, where largely white male anthropologists went to other places to study, observe people who were colonized, right? And we have that sort of legacy that's integral to the discipline, such that what anthropology has often done, it's sort of, you know, sort of it's participated in the practice of kind of imposition of its own metapragmatic sort of models of culture and ethnography onto communities, right? To sort of, you know, explain things for them, right? In these quote unquote objective ways, which, you know, it is, you know, nobody's ever objective. We all have an angle of vision, but, you know, anthropology tried to sort of cloak itself with that particular, those accounts as being authoritative. It's quite a different thing to engage with a community and try to understand their own sort of genres of communication and genres of performance and understand the intricacies of them. And not only that, but then understand the sort of power and weight that those, you know, sort of modes of performance, modalities of communication that have their own power, and that they're quite, you know, sort of complex and they serve and a particular role. And so for me, understanding all those aspects of performance, I sort of, you know, did this kind of 180, where taking those analytics to structure the way that I was trying to write and understand this experience, as opposed to imposing my own kinds of models of understanding onto, you know, this particular cultural form and community, but rather using or borrowing from what they were already sort of communicating and had developed in terms of, again, these analytics of el destino, reglamento, all the sort of aspects of performance, and having those structure the writing, have those structure the inquiry. In other words, it's this realization, like, yeah, what they're doing is ethnographic in the sense of documenting experience, translating experience. I mean, is that not ostensibly what we traditionally think of ethnography being? And so, in a sense, in performers, particularly poets themselves, I sort of thought of in a way as ethnographers. And so, you know, in that regard, you know, to think about, you know, this as a kind of project of an intellectual project of knowledge production, Huapango Ribeño itself, you know, I think a couple of things were going on here in terms of that realization. One is that, I guess, to my previous point about how there's nothing inherently political about what's being said or being done, but it's the context in which it becomes politicized. And so, I guess, to circle back to your, you know, the second part of your question is, like, what were they talking about? Well, they were talking about everything. They were talking, I mean, there's a way that decimas really are this sort of vehicle for documenting the work a day, you know. And so people talking about their journeys, talking about their everyday lives, but doing so in a way that existed and continues to, you know, sort of exist in contradistinction to the already received narratives about migrants and migrant lives that we're all saturated with, both in popular culture and popular politics and political discourse and policy making and otherwise, where we already have a conception of the immigrant or the migrant, or most egregious, the illegal, the drop and leave culprit, the anchor baby, the rapist, etc., right? Where, yeah, that narrative space exists. It's quite powerful. We're all aware of it. But yeah, it's quite another thing that in the space of performance at 3 or 4 in the morning in a crowd of thousands in the middle of central Texas, when you have improvised decimas talking about those same community members as mothers and fathers, as daughters, sons, etc., giving a kind of specificity to their life, their biography, the places that they're from, but doing it in this incredibly public way, in the moment, as everybody's being moved again, right? Quite literally zapateando to this improvised poetry, right? about who these people are, but also being moved emotively, right? And the connections that that entails, and the kind of cultural, social, and geographic mapping that's happening through poetry and performance that connects both places in Mexico and the United States. And sort of, you know, the last thing I'll mention here, you know, in terms of your question, is like, what was being communicated here? What was, you know, it was those kinds of stories and you know, that I sort of kept encountering and that I found, you know, quite sort of interesting, moving, compelling, and important to pay attention to. But I guess this is my second point from before. What I found was, you know, and I make a case for, is that through the sort of space of performance and the labor of performance, what was the way in which these kinds of bridges were enacted, and which these sort of cultural, social, immaterial crossings were given voice to, where in moments of congregation and performance is when sort of people and places were kind of dragged into view, for the listening and performing audience, where these sort of adjacencies would occur, where in a moment two places seemingly disparate would fold together.
Mm-hmm.
And
with a member of the crowd calling out, for example, to say hello to a friend somewhere else, or also as part of that, you know, the performance, you know, the narrative itself, combining those paces. Is that what you're referring to?
Precisely. Yeah. You know, that one of the chapters, the Potosí to Tennessee chapter, yeah, takes precisely a moment of improvised performance that where someone in the audience asks, hey, can you say, and this performance is taking place in San Luis Potosí, and this person in the audience asks the troubadour, hey, can you say hello to my friend in Tennessee? Now, on the surface there, right, that seems kind of, you know, kind of an absurd request or suggestion to make, right? Because clearly at the kind of material level of sound, right? Yeah, that person cannot hear what the saludado from all the way to Potosí, but it doesn't matter. In order for everything I just mentioned and its sort of hearkening magic and power is meaningful and it's important because all those things have to be true in order for a poet to take up that request without hesitation. Say, uh-huh. Yeah, of course. Yes, of course I will. I'll say hi to this person in Tennessee because the aim isn't so that that person can hear, right, what the person who the saludo is requested for can hear it, but rather how they are brought into that moment.
Yeah, there's like a longing for connection.
Precisely, right?
I mean, it's not just like a shout out, right? This is like the distinction we're trying to make. Right?
There's exactly.
Something quite, I think, spiritual, I think, and incredibly intimate about that request. And again, hearing and honoring that request, right? Yeah, from the huapanguero who views this as his calling, his or her calling, right?
Precisely, yeah. And that's in some ways, right? This. Yeah, you're definitely making these wonderful connections in the sense that, you know, that request and that practice in that moment is one that's taken up seriously and you know, it makes sense both literally and figuratively. Like figuratively it makes sense and, you know, in the sense that it has a logic to it, like, oh yeah, I understand the request, but it makes sense in the literal sense of like it animates the senses. You hear this and it stirs butterfly in your stomach. You hear the kind of buzzing and burrowing in your ears, and in that moment, in that sense of elation, this improvised verse is just as real as shaking somebody's hand. So, you know, that entire hearkening magic, I think, really becomes apparent, I think, once taking at their own word, and quite seriously, these what we might call it kind of vernacular analytics around this particular performance form of Huapango Arribeño. And it speaks to, I think, you know, a word that you brought up that I do talk quite a bit about in the book, and that's the senses of intimacy, right? The sort of embodied moment of connection, and which, you know, lends me to sort of utilize this analytic of aural kind of poetics, drawing on notions in anthropology and other places, this notion of cultural poetics, but I lend the term some specificity here with notion of orality, you know, the sort of the condition of listening and hearing, and how that, you know, shapes. It's through these sort of sonic enactments that of enactment and reception and their circulation that it engenders a kind of intimacy, right, that is heard and therefore quite materially felt, but also how sound as a kind of envelope is one that's quite capacious with meanings. Like when you hear a sound, when we hear a song, when we hear a lyric, or we hear a poetic, you know, the things and meanings and ideas that invokes, you know, possesses that sort of that quality. And so I use that as an idea, as an interpretive mode, right? And I guess in part is even just to think about the book's title, right? It's really to try and trace how it is that sounds resonance spreads in these sort of also ethereal forms, right? Through memory, which is both individual and cultural, through trauma or through storytelling, through repetition, but that it moves, right, through obstacles like social divisions and transmits the kind of vibration of its messages. It sort of pierces the divisions between things or across places. And so it crosses. So.
Yeah, that's powerful. You know, I don't want to have to wrap things up because it's what you do an incredible job of, and what I really appreciate is, and I can only imagine the struggle it was to try to write in this way to bring the reader into that space. And that's a lot of what you've been describing. And I feel it again. I feel as if, like, when I was reading, you know, the text of what it's like to be in these spaces, whether that be in Central Texas or Tennessee, or, you know, Memphis, or, you know, Guanajuato, or San Luis Potosi, or wherever it may be, right? But to actually be there, it's incredibly powerful. So I thank you for that, and I thank you for taking time to share with us your work. I wanted to give you both, again, the last word to either add anything you feel we haven't covered about Huapango Arribeño or Huapangueros, and to also maybe share and connect this to, you know, the projects you're currently working on.
Yeah, sure. No, well, thank you for the invitation to chat about this work in particular, which, you know, I still feel very close to, even though I'm sort of doing other work now, but you know, I lived a long time with this book, with this research, which read on my dissertation and subsequent research beyond that, that then, you know, became the book. And you know, I, you know, for, you know, for those interested either, you know, in this music or in kind of engaging with the book, I do appreciate your words there in terms of the writing of it. One hopes that, you know, or rather, you know, you don't know how things are going to be. We put things out in the world and you don't know how they're going to be received. And I felt very fortunate that a lot of people seem to have connected with this particular book and this work. And I think, you know, perhaps one aspect of that is kind of what you mentioned in terms of how it's written. And I will say that, you know, the inspiration for writing and the style that I did was precisely the sort of the poetics of Huapango itself, right? I mean, the challenge was to try and, you know, represent the vibrancy, the sort of the intimacy, sort of sensing that is so much a part of this world of performance, and it, you know, so I took my cue from that to try to mirror what I was experiencing, you know, ethnographically, you know, and as a performer too. And so so I think that's kind of one element there that's I think definitely part of the character of what the book is and what it's become for people and how people connect with it. And you know, one thing I was able to do to extend the kind of reach and life of the book was I worked with the Smithsonian Folkways to produce an album, actually just prior to when the book came out. It's called Serrano de Corazón. It features Guillermo Velázquez y Los Leones de la Sierra de Hichu. And Guillermo Velázquez and those musicians, they all populate the book. They're all there. they're all over the book. And so they're friends of mine. I've known them for a long time. And long story short, I had this opportunity to work with the Smithsonian, who at that point, the curator was Dan Sheehy. And it took us a few years, but we went down to Querétaro and made a record, and it came out on Smithsonian Folkways. It's a really amazing experience. I encourage people to check it out as well. It's available on most streaming platforms, but also if you go online and just search, you know, Smithsonian Folkways Huapango Ribeño, you'll find actually some really interesting videos of what we did in the studio of performance and all the rest. And also, if on the Smithsonian Folkways website, you can download the liner notes, which was actually a really great experience because I got to write them. And that's one of the things that I love about Folkways Records is they have these really amazing liner notes. So I had the opportunity to curate them myself. So that was great. Beyond that, I mean, I continue to, you know, write and perform, and I have multiple projects that I'm working on musically, whether my own or collaborating with others. And as you mentioned at the beginning, some stuff around film, some collaborative projects too, across kind of multiple or with multiple collaborators, Mexico and the United States, just kind of work that I continue to do. Research-wise, it's interesting. I've sort of pivoted to Chicago, where I live, to do, been working a few years now, but this project on sound and Latinos in the city is kind of like a question of urbanism and space and placemaking in relation to the kind of racialized experience of Latinos in the city and how sound is one way of telling that story. And it's kind of interesting because it's sort of the opposite of what I've done. So whereas in Sounds of Crossing, you know, I was looking at multiple places and how one sound existed across these places, right? Huapango Ribeño. This is the opposite. It's how multiple sounds exist in this one particular site, which is the city of Chicago. So it's kind of a different kind of approach, but you know, it's been good work, and you know, just kind of working away on that and trying to get things out there based on it. So yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. And again, Alex, thank you for your time and for visiting with us on New Books in Latino Studies.
No, thank you for having me, and I really enjoyed it.